Greetings and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the Forum, we'll examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We'll bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, on this 127th day of the year 2011, several milestone anniversaries are being celebrated in our history. 150 years ago, the brutal Civil War was launched, and 50 years ago, the Freedom Riders movement was formed in the southern United States. Joining us today will be Stanley Nelson. He is the director of the documentary film Freedom Riders, which is creating a buzz even before it premieres on PBS television very soon. This film chronicles a courageous band of civil rights activists in the 1960s. And in our Caribbean Theater of the Mind segment, joining us from New York will be Tangerine Clark. She's the editor of the newsletter of the Guyana Cultural Association, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary of the Guyana Folk Festival. And hopefully, before we wrap up at 11 o'clock this morning, we hope to be joined by the artistic director of the Caribbean Cultural Theater, Ewan MacDonald. He's spearheading the celebration of the company's Poets and Passions series. So stay tuned for the next 2 hours here on Caribbean Forum. We heard every Saturday morning from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time on the Uhuru Radio Network. Well, Caribbean Forum would not be complete without checking in with the CEO of News Americas, an online news portal, your gateway to diverse markets. We'll be back after listening to Calypso Rose. We'll be joined by Miss Felicia Passard. Rosie said, I'm back, and yes, we will be back.
Hot, 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 hot time. boy, Thunder Rolling. That is Calypso Rose. Calypso Rose
said, I will be back. Yes, you'll be back hotter than ever.
Here you listen to Caribbean Forum with me,
Ron Bob Sample, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We are here Saturday mornings from 9 until 11. And as usual, Saturday mornings, we'll joined by Ms. Felicia Prasad, the CEO of Heartbeat Communication. And good morning, Felicia, and again, welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Very good morning to you, Ron, and to all the listeners, and I'm definitely back.
Well, some of us may also coin the phrase and said, I'm definitely black. But we'll leave that alone. So how are you doing, Felicia?
I'm very good. The weather is great here, so that is a positive. When you wake up and you see blue sky and the sun is out, and it feels great.
Well, you're in New York, and when you say the weather is great, you have to explain that.
Well, because, it actually because that, feels that weather in New really
York,
warm.
That weather in New York has been crazy since last November.
I know, but it's really been, I think it's been really great these past few days. And today seems exceptionally much better than it's been all week. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, weather-wise, you know, there's all that flooding that is going on in the Mississippi area region there in the southern United States after those tornadoes last week. So having some nice weather in New York is a good sign.
It definitely is. And, Ron, also there's tremendous flooding that's happening around South America as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Specifically in Brazil.
Brazil and even Colombia.
What's happening there as far as...
Flooding as well that's creating landslides, that's killing folks, that's moving many out of the areas. So it really seems like the entire climate change is affecting all areas around the world.
Do you think folks are paying attention to that global warming epidemic? That not epidemic, but you know, the talk about global warming about 5-8 years ago, and a lot of folks are just turning deaf ears.
Yeah, I think that really is the problem. Folks are not paying attention, and this is really creeping up very carefully. In fact, I heard a forecaster yesterday say that the current areas where people are living now in Mississippi was once not areas where people should be living, because it was an area created for this sort of land and water to sort of flow evenly. But now they've created homes, they've created areas in these places, and nature is, I guess, starting to come back right around and really reclaiming what was it. And now here is the problem.
On a smaller scale, that takes me back to our native land, Guyana, whereby the Dutch had built those gutters and those tributaries so that that water can run off in event of flooding. But over the years, they have been filled up, and that attributes to a lot of flooding that goes on, especially in Georgetown.
Absolutely. And then also, Ron, it's the same issue, I'm being told, in many of the areas where they're creating these housing developments. A lot of that land was just swampland that was not really meant for people to be building homes on or living on. So the water has a natural way of flowing, and it's just doing what it's been doing forever. And now here are these homes in the middle of it. And this is happening not just in the U.S. and Guyana, but all across the Caribbean. I'm told even in Jamaica, when they have those heavy floodings and you hear about roads being washed away, this is also what is the problem, because people have moved into areas where they shouldn't really have built or be living.
Kamau Braffitt, the author and poet from Barbados, you know, refers to it as concrete jungle there in Barbados.
Hmm.
You know, where
very interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Turning to the news or other news, Felicia, the Dudas Coke incident seems to be back in the news, in that the D.C. law firm Manat Phelps and Phillips was also doing business elsewhere in the Caribbean.
Yeah, that is exactly what we discovered at News America's Now this week, because the Justice Department has released its latest Foreign Agents Act report. And that comes out every half, they do it for every 6 months period. And the latest one is actually ending in the half of 2010. And it seems that the Manaf, Phelps, and Phillips, the little-known story, because everyone focused on Jamaica and their new business with Jamaica, but these guys have been doing business with the Dominican Republic since 2008. And they've actually earned about over $1 million doing business for the Dominican Republic, lobbying basically for the Dominican Republic. And it's very interesting because then they also took on Jamaica in 2009, and we all know how that ended. That commission is yet to rule. It's actually going to rule, they say, on May 16th of whether the government actually committed any sort of misappropriation in hiring this commission to lobby for the prevention of extradition of Dudas Coke. So it's going to be interesting. But in the meanwhile, these guys have racked up, you know, over $2 million.
Was this being done under the radar?
Well, obviously not, because I think it's legitimate. They've done their filings. They've actually listed themselves and saying that they are doing business with foreign governments. So I don't think it's anything on their part. I think the concern in Jamaica came because of the fact that Dudas Coke actually is an accused drug lord. He was wanted here. He's now here in prison awaiting a trial. And obviously the government was trying to prevent his extradition to the United States. And that is where the problem comes in, because if you're going to lobby against the extradition of an accused criminal, then there is something very wrong with that if a government is going to take that stance. And I think that's where Manaf, Phelps, and Phillips really got into some serious trouble and also created a lot of bad press for themselves. I think they're still reeling from that.
What's the latest out of Haiti with the new president?
Well, the president is getting ready for his inauguration. It's very interesting because we have someone who is actually on the ground in Haiti. In fact, he's a Guyanese who has migrated to Haiti. And he has some very interesting take on what's going on in Haiti, Ron. And it's really great because, you know, this is someone who is not Haitian. He's not lived there before, so he's really seeing it with fresh eyes. And what he's saying is that things are not changing, really. It's business as usual. It's a small percentage of folks who really voted for Michel Martelly, and so they're optimistic. But generally, the people are still living in the tents. People are still struggling. And what these nonprofits are creating and claiming that they're building homes are basically like little garages that we have at the back of our homes. That's what they're calling homes that they're putting people in. And on top of it, it's not creating employment for anyone, because many of the people are being told they need to give sweat equity in order to earn these homes, these basically shacks. And so that really is the situation. Meanwhile, you have someone like Duvalier, who he said is really just having a good time. He's going around living on the jazz circuit, really hanging out with all the folks and living it up, and no one seems to be bothered about this.
And he's just supposed to have returned to Haiti for 3 days.
Exactly. So he had a stint in the hospital. Yes, he's been charged, but They haven't arrested him. He's not in jail, so he's living it up. I mean, he has money. And then Michel Martelly is obviously talking about having him as a potential person that counsels him. So it's very scary when you think about it. But then the other flip side is, exactly what can Martelly deliver? Can he really deliver for the people? Or is he really in the pockets of the people who put him there? And that is the question that many people are really starting to ask.
What do you think was the real reason for Jean-Bertrand Aristide returning to Haiti?
I'm not really sure, Ron. It's very interesting because he's been so quiet. In fact, our reporter also said that he's been so quiet. He has said absolutely nothing at all. He's just stayed within his own compound. Nobody really sees him much. And also, maybe he'll make an appearance at this inauguration, because we're told Martelly invited him as well to be there. I'm not sure he's going to show up. but he really hasn't said anything. So I guess he was right in saying he just wanted to get back to his homeland and maybe just relax and focus on education and focus on teaching, and maybe that's what he's going to do.
Well, we'll find out. Felicia, tell us about that potential foreign direct investment in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Well, the fact is that we're having this on June 9th, and that is something that's coming up pretty shortly. And it's very interesting, Ron, because it comes on the heels of the fact that the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean is predicting that investment in that region could grow by as much as 25% this year. So they're definitely optimistic about both Latin America and the Caribbean, and we're optimistic about the Caribbean especially. We want to put the spotlight on the Caribbean because we believe that too often the Caribbean gets dumped in as just the playground, as just the sun, sand, and sea. You know, we are great party people. Beyond that, we're not really important. And so we want to put the spotlight on the region in a very serious way, just as Latin America, especially Brazil, has done, in saying, no, we have the opportunities, we have the potential, now we need to match the investors with the investment opportunities. And that's what the June 9th event is about. It's not a talk shop. It's really about real people, real investors with real money looking for opportunities. And we're bringing in these ministers of government. Hopefully they're going to bring some opportunities to the table that folks can really seriously look at and have a really great networking and dialogue. And this is also open to entrepreneurs, attorneys, you know, people who are really interested in doing business in the Caribbean. We're really hoping that they will also join us at Invest Caribbean 2011. And obviously for more information, they can log on to investcaribbeannow.com, or our news site, newsamericasnow.com, also has a banner link that takes you directly to that to sign up.
Beautiful. Monty Alexander continues to celebrate his 50th anniversary in music. What an accomplishment.
It definitely is. And you know what, Ron? It's not so much that it seems phenomenal. There's just been so many years that Monty has been doing this. But to me, Monty is also such an incredible person that I have yet to see as much humility with younger artists that are coming up. And I think that is something that they really need to look at.
You make an excellent point there, Felicia.
It really amazes me that you see these young artists that are coming up and suddenly they have an entourage, they have all this arrogance. There is just, you know, you can't even talk to them because they're just so much around them suddenly. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me that Monty keeps such humility, always nice. I mean, I can't think of anyone who would say that Monty has been rude to them, because he's always everywhere alone, very simple, very humble, always a wonderful smile, always a great word. And that, I think, really is what draws me to him and lets me work with him as I don't do for many artists that approach me, because I really don't like to work with artists. Because of the fact of, you know, many of them have too much attitude for my liking. Monty is just such a refreshing person. And I think that is something that probably has kept him going for this long in the business.
One of the key things is that, excuse me, one of the key things is that he remembers where he came from. He remembers his roots, he remembers his upbringing, and those who are responsible for where he is today.
Oh, absolutely. And that is so, so important, Ron. You know, I was at an Italian museum event last night, and the two words that stood out from all the people there, the honorees, the organizers, it was origin and heritage. And they kept repeating that throughout the night. And these are people who are, you know, major players in the country right now, people who have really done well for themselves. But they all remember their roots. Many were not born in Italy, but they all remember their roots because their parents were. They came here mm-hmm. as poor immigrants, and they didn't know English. They struggled like every immigrant family does to assimilate, to send their kids to school, to really struggle. And the children have not forgotten that. And that is something that really blew me away. I said, you know, many of us in the Caribbean community, we really need to make sure that our kids are grounded and that we keep that humility. We remember our history, because that is the most important thing. If you don't remember your history, you don't know where you're coming from. You really don't know where you're going.
Absolutely. There are elections coming up in the Caribbean, in St. Lucia, in Guyana. What's the atmosphere like with the preparations that are going on?
Well, I'm not really sure about St. Lucia. I haven't been following that as closely as I should have. But I think Guyana, I think people need to really focus on that in terms of pushing the opposition parties. If they think that they are the ones, they're the answer, then people need to really push them from within both parties to really come together, form some sort of coalition, and go up into this election. The election hasn't been called yet, so I think it's still there is still time for this to happen. It really needs to happen, Ron, because to have another 4 years of this current this government, obviously it will be a different administration and a different government, but the same PPP civic government to continue another 4 years or 5 years, I really don't think that's an option, and that is what should be driving folks to really push the opposition PNC and the Alliance for Change. If they're really serious about the country and the people and change, then they need to come together, move beyond partisan politics, move beyond all the nonsense that's happened, the self-serving, and really make sure that they send a very strong message. I think people are waiting for that. Many people are anxious for that. I think this election is going to be an election. If they can make that happen, it's going to be really dynamic. And we're going to stop hearing this whole nonsense about race voting. Because if they can come together, then I think the race voting would definitely become a countrywide voting. And it would definitely bring a breath of fresh air. Because I think people in both parties are very, very disturbed. And especially, I think the PPP is losing its base in Guyana, and that's why it keeps running out here to try to drum up support. The people are just, they're frustrated. They're not going to vote. I think it's going to probably be the lowest voting turnout if you look at it in a few months.
Yeah, we were chatting with Dr. David Hines last Saturday, and we were talking about that whole Appenjatt situation back in the 60s. And now, Felicia, we are in May. This is the 7th of May. And the election date still has not been announced yet. The president, President Barrow Jagdeo, and his selected nominee, David Ramatar, were in New York last week, and there was that fracas there at the at that club there in Queens. What's the holdup? Why hasn't a definitive date been set, you think?
I really am not sure. I think the PPP is trying to drum up its own support base because it realizes that locally it's losing them. A lot of Indo-Guyanese are very frustrated, and that's largely been their base. They're very, very disturbed at what's happened with the PPP since 92 and since Chetty Jagan died. It's just been like so many changes that they can't even understand what is going on. They see the blatant alleged corruption in their face. They see everything that's happening, and they're just very disappointed. I think that's what Jagdeo is sort of holding out, hoping that he can sort of drum up support and delay it as long as possible so that they can ensure another PPP win. And if the PNC and the Alliance and all these other guys are smart, they would get themselves together like the Trinidad opposition did and make sure that there is no way that this PPP gets back in power, because it's become another dictator. How many times are we going to go through the same syndrome of going through a dictatorship? It only sets the country back many, many years, and that's what's happening. I mean, how long is Guyana going to do this when every other Caribbean country is moving ahead economically and socially and every other way, and Guyana continues to be left there? I mean, it's like a laughing stock, and you're embarrassed. And that is why Guyanese, whether it's Barbados or across the Caribbean, they're treated the way that they are, because people think we're a joke, even though we have so much going on for us as a country. We're a huge country. We're not a little dot in the sea. And yet here it is that we're embarrassed consistently because of our rulers.
Are Guyanese abroad eligible to vote in these upcoming elections?
That's the other thing. No. I mean, why is that? And I've made the case that I think every Caribbean person should be allowed to vote in their election overseas. Why is that not happening when every other country in the world is starting to do that? The U.S. does that, whether their folks are in the bases or wherever they are, they do that. Why is it that we can't do that? You know, people have made the case, well, there may be a lot of fraud engaged that happens overseas. Well, there's a lot of monitors that can go into place to make that not happen. So why is that not happening? And why is it that people feel they can continue to support governments back home without demanding some sort of return on their investment? I just don't understand that. You know, every time they come here begging for money, and this is not just Guyana, this is everywhere, Jamaica, Trinidad, Haiti, everywhere. They come here every time around the election, but then the diaspora suddenly is not important after the election.
That's right.
You know, we can't go back there. We can't really run for office. We can't get the business. Other people are coming in and investing and making the money. Why is that? And those are things I think the diaspora needs to really take these folks to task with. I think the Haitian diaspora has stepped up its rallying call. We need to take an example and really make sure that the Guyanese, because this election is coming up, we need to change this, Ron. Look, you call the consulate, you can't even get the consulate general as a media person to say anything at all. You call the consulate, it's a joke here in New York. Now you have to fly home to Guyana to get a new passport. I was just telling someone this the other day. The person was born in Guyana of Jamaican and Guyanese parents. The father is Guyanese. And the person was asking me about getting a Guyanese passport. And I told them blatantly, you know what, forget about it, because you have to fly to Guyana to get the passport.
Why is that?
You know, why is that? This is because the PPP has a new rule that says that you have to fly to Guyana. I mean, who comes up with these stupid things? And this passes the parliament. Who is going to pay at least $2,000 to go to Guyana for a passport? And then you have to stand in line there, and you're not sure when you're going to get it. It's really a nightmare, and I just don't understand why people are taking this nonsense, and you're not seeing as much outrage when it's taxpayer dollars funding the consulate, funding all these things. And the government now is turning around and seems to be campaigning on taxpayer dollars. Because why else would the president come here and not do anything beyond his political rally?
And as you mentioned, he didn't even give the media the courtesy of conducting several interviews.
Nothing at all, and not even a press conference.
Well, Felicia, thank you again for bringing us up to date on what's happening in the Caribbean. Of course, if I had time, we would have continued this for another half an hour. See you next week, Felicia.
Thank you so much, Ron. Appreciate it.
If I only had time, dreams to pursue. If I only had time, they'd be mine. Time, like the wind, goes a-hurrying by, and the hours just fly. Where to begin? There are mountains I'd climb if I had time. Since I met you, I've thought life really is too short. Loving you, so many things we could make true. Satisfy me. So much to do. If I only had time, if I only had time, dreams to pursue. If I only had time, they'd be mine.
Yeah. Yes, if I only had time. You listen to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We hear Saturday mornings from 9 until 11 Eastern Standard Time. We were just chatting with Felicia Passan out of New York, and we're going to stay in New York, and joining me this morning is Ms. Tangerine Clark. She is the editor of the...
with Ron Bob Semple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time.
She is the editor of the newsletter of the Ghana Cultural Association. Tangerine, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning, Ron. Thank you so much, first of all, for having the Ghana Cultural Association on your show. Congratulations on Caribbean Forum. I'm so excited that we're going to be celebrating 10 years this
right.
year, the Ghana Cultural Association. And first of all, I would like to say Happy Mother's Day to the mothers out there.
And also the Mr. Moms.
And the Mr. Moms, of course. and for those mothers in the New York area, we would love for them to spend their special day with us.
Yes, and we are... Yeah. I know you have an event coming up, and we're going to get into that, Tangerine, if you just don't mind putting a pin on that.
Okay.
Let's just talk about the association, the Ghana Cultural Association. What are some of the goals and objectives of the GCA?
Well, Ron, as you know, the Ghana Cultural Association is a nonprofit group. And over the late years, as a matter of fact, 10 years this year, our mission has been to document, showcase, and celebrate the multiple roots of Guyanese cultural heritage. Through our work, we preserve our cultural heritage and make it available through various channels, right, to inspire future generations of Guyanese, not only here, but
okay.
at home in Ghana. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You said not only here, but also in Guyana.
Absolutely.
Here being North America.
North America.
Do you reach out to those Guyanese who are, say, in London, in Australia, in Sweden,
Absolutely.
Because we're all over the world?
Absolutely. And, you know, in short, we preserve, promote, and propagate our Guyanese culture, and that's what we're very proud of.
In what way do you do that?
In various aspects. We, through our events, our Family Fun Day, our symposium, our literary hang, our kwekwe, you know, all of those events, you know, highlight our cultural heritage.
For those listeners who do not know what kwekwe is, just give us a brief explanation, please.
Well, kwekwe is a ceremony that's held the night before a wedding. Good night, eh, we come tell ya, good night, eh. And these are some of the songs that, you know, we sing and to showcase our culture. You go on the bottom house, the family, all of the neighbors come to your bottom house, and we dance and we sing. Colored girl in the ring, show me your kwekwe, come to me kwekwe. You know, it's a very stirring festival and celebration to highlight Guyanese weddings.
Does this celebration come out of Africa?
It came out of Africa. It's a celebration that came out of Africa. And you know, it's well documented in Guyana. And Guyanese are known for having the best kwekwe ever before a wedding, the day before the wedding.
Why a folk festival?
Well, Ron, as you know, I was just saying, because we want to keep our cultural heritage alive in North America, and we encourage everybody around the world, wherever Guyanese are, to come out and acknowledge that, you know, we are a multicultural heritage. We came from a multicultural heritage, and it's something that is very exciting and colorful, and that is why we try to keep it alive through our events every year at our folk festival.
The reason I asked why a folk festival, because, you know, just the word folk, you know, many countries do have folk festivals, and some of them take different forms and fashions. You know, I mean, is there anything specific about the Ghana Folk Festival that may be different from others?
Well, I think it's because we're multiracial. We have six races, and we get an opportunity to highlight each and every one of those heritage, our heritage. And over the years, you know, it has been quite an experience. And we have gotten so much feedback from our patrons, people who've come to the festival over the years, and they've always talked about the Guyana Cultural Association being special, the folk festival being special, because we're always there to highlight what is so special in the Guyanese, you know, community.
If you've just joined us, we're chatting with Tangerine Clark. She's the editor of the newsletter of the Guyana Cultural Association and getting ready to celebrate 10 years of the Folk Festival. If you'd like to join us here on Caribbean Forum and you're calling within the United States, you can call us at area code 727-565-1599. 727-565-1599. If you're listening to us from across the pond and you'd like to join us in discourse out of the UK, it's 44-020-8133-6629, or you can Skype us. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, U-H-U-R-U Radio. Tangerine, over the years, the Guyana Cultural Association has honored a number of prominent and not-so-prominent Guyanese. Are there any special aspects to this 10th anniversary celebration?
Well, so far, we have put out a call for nominations, okay, right? And you know, we have, as you said, we have honored some of the greatest people. We have honored Ia Braithwaite, you know, a well-known
author of To Serve With Love.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are so many others that we have highlighted, we have, you know, honored over the years. This year, our call for nominations, we're going to be celebrating, actually, I should say first, All Body, One Body. That's our theme for this year, which is going to encompass all of our cultures, all of our diversity. And while I'm on the topic, I just want to ask people to log on to our website and get out there and nominate somebody who you think is deserving of this award, someone who's been very instrumental in the community, in highlighting their culture, in doing whatever.
What's that website? And we'll make sure that we announce it later on.
Right.
What's that website?
It's www.guyfolkfest.org. That's GUYFOLKFEST.org.
Okay. What other events do you have planned leading up to the event that occurs, the Family Day Festival over the Labor Day weekend?
Well, yeah, the festival is going to start on June 1st. And we're going to have a Moonlight Night storytelling because full moon is going to be on June 1st. So we want to make sure that we're having that storytelling on that particular night. And that is going to be held at St. Stephen's Church, and that's on in Newkirk Avenue in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And again, everything is going to be highlighted on our website. So if you want to know more about all of our events, you can go to our website. Then we're going to have a literary hang, and that's going to be held on Sunday, June 5th at St. John's Episcopal Church, and that's on St. John's Place, again, Brooklyn.
What's a literary hang?
The literary hang is an annual event that sets out to explore and celebrate Guyana's literature, and it's one of our signature events at the Folk Festival. This year's event will feature extended conversations with six distinguished innovators in Guyanese expressive culture.
Okay.
And among the confirmed participants are Peter Jailal. He just released a book of poetry. It's on the Indian arrival in Guyana. The name of it is Sacrifice. We have Roslyn McCalmont, Yvonne McCallum-Peters. We have William Lloyd Andres, you know, Sarah Andres. We have, of course, Ken Cosby, Morris Braithwaite, Cynthia Nelson. She just released a cookbook. And it's the name of the book is Taste of Guyanese Home. So these are some of the authors we're going to be highlighting this year.
Tangerine, does the Guyana Cultural Association make a concerted effort to reach out to other Caribbean nationals? I know it's a Guyana Folk Festival, it's a Guyana Cultural Association. Is a concerted effort being made to bring other Caribbean nationals to these events? Because a lot of what happens, there's so much similarity within the Caribbean culture.
Absolutely, Ron. As a matter of fact, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, the team was celebrating the Caribbean. And every year, we invite everyone from the Caribbean. And I don't know, maybe you have seen some of the Caribbean performers, people like, you know, not the Mighty Sparrow, but people who have, from his time, who have performed at the Folk Festival. And of course, we do reach out the Caribbean community, and, you know, we encourage them to be a part of our culture because, you know, we're all Caribbean people.
Yes, I'm sorry about that. Yes, of course, we are all Caribbean people, and, you know, all body, one body. What does that translate into?
It translates the diverse culture. We have six races, and we're going to be celebrating all of those races, all of everybody in the Guyanese community. One body, all of us, we're going to be celebrating this year.
Yes, we're talking with, I'm here. We're talking with Tangerine Clark, the editor of the newsletter of the Guyana Cultural Association out in New York. They're preparing for their 10th year anniversary. This all culminates on Labor Day weekend. Just give us a rundown, Tangerine, so what's going to happen that particular weekend?
For the particular weekend, well, other than our literary hang, and we're going to be having a performing arts festival, and that's going to be at my 11th school. And this year, the performing arts festival will showcase Francis Farrier's adaptation of C.L.R. James's Minty Alley, and that's going to be directed by Maurice Braithwaite, one of our members. And we usually have a summer heritage camp for our youth, and we're going to have that as well. We're going to have an art exhibition. And then it's going to culminate with the GCA Awards ceremony.
Who is being honored this year?
Yeah. We're going to be honoring 12 persons in the categories of the Guyana Cultural Association Award, the Guyana Cultural Association Youth Award. Then we have a Lifetime Achievement Award and an Exemplary Award. Sorry, I'm like so crazy, so confused. Anyway, Ron. So those are some of the events. And then we're going to have the Family Fun Day. And we're still waiting for a venue for that. And that is going to be on September 4th. That's the Sunday. We also have a symposium that's going to be on the 3rd of September at Columbia University. So those are some of the events that we're going to be showcasing this year.
What's the theme of that symposium?
The theme of the symposium is Arrivals, Encounters, and Exchange.
Okay. Could you explain that a little further for us? You know, so that we can just get an idea for as to, you know, what topics will be
We still yet to confirm some of the persons who would be doing presentations.
Okay.
We haven't confirmed that as yet. So as soon as we get that, that's going to be on our website. Thanks, Mark.
Now, every day is Mother's Day, as far as I'm concerned. But there's someone or some group of folks who got together and felt that a particular day should be for mothers and to celebrate Mother's Day, and that is tomorrow, May 8th. The Guyana Cultural Association has a special event tomorrow honoring mothers from Guyana. Tell us more about that, please.
Well, I want to say congratulations and happy Mother's Day to all of those mothers out there. And for those mothers and their families in the New York area, we're going to be hosting a Mother's Day dinner theater, and that where we're going to honor 10 special mothers of courage. That is going to be held at St. Stephen's Church, and that's at the corner of Newkirk and East 29th Street, and that's in Brooklyn. It starts at 5 p.m. sharp, and we're going to have door prizes. We're going to have also a silent auction and a cultural presentation, and of course, we're going to have a hat parade. So we're inviting all mothers and the families to just come out and have a great time at the Guyana Cultural Association. We're just asking for a $35 donation, and tickets can be purchased at the door.
Earlier,
that's tomorrow, May 8th.
Earlier you mentioned that the Guyana Cultural Association is a nonprofit organization. How are you funded?
Well, through fundraising. I mean, we're a nonprofit, and we try as much to put on events to raise funds. You know, that's our main goal right now, raising funds so that we can, you know, promote our culture in a better way. So, fundraising, that's what we've been doing so far.
Well, Tangerine Clark, thank you very much. Thank you very much for joining us this morning here on Caribbean Forum. And all the best to you and the members and the staff of the Ghana Cultural Association. And I'd like to congratulate your new president, Mr. Vibert Cambridge.
That's right. Thank you for reminding me about that, Ron. Yes, congratulations to our new president, Dr. Vibert Cambridge, and our new vice president, Mr. Romesh Singh. And we also want to thank our past immediate past president, Malcolm Hall, for the great job that he did over the 9 years.
Absolutely.
So thank you to everyone. And Ron, thank you so much for making me feel a little comfortable. You know, I was a little off balance sometimes, but, you know.
Excuse me. Tangerine. Excuse me.
Thank you so much.
Tangerine Clark, off balance? Unheard of.
Good night, Dale. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you very much. That's Tangerine Clark, the editor of the I've been talking off mic. Yes, that was Tangerine Clark, and she joined us from New York. She's the editor of the newsletter of the Ghana Cultural Association, and they are looking forward to culminating these events on the Labor Day weekend with a literary hang and the family day. And, of course, you're all invited. And please, you log on to the website for further information. It's guyfolkfest.org. That's guyfolkfest.org. We're going to return with them. Take a break and we return with Mr. Stanley Nelson. He is the director of Freedom Fighters. And here's just a sample of the Freedom Ride with Congressman John Lewis.
Lots of violence and hate shall turn us from our no Jim Crow law, no police state can stop this free-bound soul. 3,000 students banned in jail, so lift their heads and sing. Travel on to freedom like songbirds on the wing. Heed the call, Americans all, side by equal side.
The Freedom Ride of the 60s changed America forever. Seeing a moving movement, a rolling movement, traveling by bus through the South, pricking the conscience of the American people.
We're taking a large group of students to points of interest that have made a significant influence on our history, and we're doing it with those people who participated in history and helped make the changes themselves.
Good morning, how are you? Boy, you've got everything in here, haven't you?
I hope to take a journey back in time to see what it was like for some of my mother, father, grandparents living in America and how segregation really affected their lives.
Hallelujah, I'm a traveler. Hallelujah, ain't it fine? Hallelujah, I'm a traveler. Born of freedom, made
alive. We left Washington on May 4th, 1961. Some on a Greyhound bus and some on a Trailway bus. And in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, my seatmate, Abba Bigelow, the two of us tried to enter a so-called white waiting room. And the moment we started through the door, a group of young white men attacked us and left us lying in a pool of blood. But because of the violence that occurred in Anniston, Alabama, between Atlanta and Birmingham, the burning of the bus, And the beating of the Freedom Riders on a trailway bus in Birmingham, Corps suspended the ride. And I came back to Nashville. Diane Nash and the students here took a position that we could not allow the threat of violence to stop a nonviolent campaign.
John was beaten and jailed, subjected to horrible abuse, and still with all of that, he lives in Congress, still seeking to help create what he calls the beloved community.
Jail door open and they walk till
that time. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on, hold on.
And they were not trying to be martyrs. They were afraid, they were anxious, they had families, but they said, I will do X. I will no longer accept Y. And then lived it out. Ordinary people. And again, for me, they are this nation's greatest gift.
But I guess you could say an analogy of what we're seeing today, I kind of figure us all as, I guess you could say archaeologists. They're like, we're just picking through the bones a little bit of all the history, but now that we had the people talk in front of us, it was like they're putting flesh to the bones.
And it was suggested that the 10 of us that had been selected write a note to our loved ones in the event of our death, put it in an envelope, left them with Diane to be forwarded to our families if we were killed. And I told my mother, I love you so much, but I've got to go. She said, you can't. You can't go. You can't do this to us. And I said, Mom, I've got to go. I love you. And she shouted, you've killed your father, and hung up. When we were driving into the bus terminal, there didn't seem to be any traffic or people on the streets. And we got off the bus, it was quiet except for the media there. And then all of a sudden, from the terminal, from around the corners, from everywhere, people. And they were screaming, get them, kill the niggers, get them, get the niggers. Being a little taller than some of them and being white, I kind of figured I stood out a little bit. So knowing what was coming, I bowed my head and I prayed. And in that moment, I had the most powerful religious experience of my life. Made me know that no matter what happened, whether I lived or whether I died, it was going to be all right. But I was grabbed and pulled over a railing, thrown to the ground. And as I got to all fours to try and get back to the group, I was kicked in my spine. That's when I had 3 vertebrae broken. I was thrown forward through on my back, and a boot came down in my face. And that's basically the last thing I remember.
Those of us who are on the Freedom Ride, or will continue the Freedom Ride, I'm not sure that I'll be able to, but we're going on to New Orleans, no matter what happens. We're dedicated to this. We'll take hitting, we'll take beating. We're willing to accept death. But we're going to keep coming until we can ride from anywhere in the South to any place else in the South without anybody making any comments, just as American citizens.
What's your name?
An honor.
her to do it again.
When you know you're
so good to see you.
The first part of our panel discussion is going to be that day in Montgomery when the Freedom Rides actually arrived.
In the moment we started down the steps, an angry mob just came out of nowhere. First attacking not us, not the Freedom Riders, but members of the media. And the mob turned on us, started beating Jim and the two of us up against the wall. And we were left lying in a pool of blood. And it was Floyd Mann, the public safety director, who came up and he pointed his gun straight up in the air and said, "There'll be no killing here today, there'll be no killing here today." And the mob dispersed.
That was the period of time where I started making decisions about whether I could do a better job of coordinating from Nashville or from Montgomery. And so very shortly I came into Montgomery. But there were still students in Nashville that kept the office running.
Please go in the very front. Freedom Riders in the front row, please.
Okay, we'll just take photos for about 30 seconds straight here, so just keep smiling.
And call it smiling.
But someone had told me back in 1961 that you would see Vanderbilt University, Tennessee State, and FIS and American Baptist together on a bus, or to see the large number of African American students attending Vanderbilt. It is so gratifying, it is so moving.
Martin Luther King's quote that everyone kept repeating was, "You haven't lived until you found something worth dying for," and I haven't found that yet. And I realized, you know, that's pretty profound and it's pretty inspiring. And so, coming back to Vanderbilt, I want to look for something that really inspires me.
Coming to Vanderbilt in a totally different environment, it was my first experience as a minority, and it was just very difficult to adjust in trying to identify these feelings and, you know, what is this history, where does this come from, like, where do I fit in American society, basically. And hearing the Freedom Riders talk just put that in a different light, and I just feel like I was in the 60s this weekend.
One thing that we did right on that day, we started to fight.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on.
I think of so many people that gave so much. Nobody knows their names. The army, the workers, the marchers.
You're under arrest. Get their name.
It was hard not to tear up here in the museum. A few minutes ago, I was standing there watching Jim's work, standing with some of our students.
Watching himself. And I guess at this point I'm just very honored and humbled to be a part of this.
We can walk through these every day and you see the pictures, but you make us realize by being here that you were once like us, and that in giving us that, this right here, we can see that your extraordinary acts came from a place that is not unlike the one in which we live right now. And that makes it possible to know that even if the challenges facing are our nation and our generation and our lives in this world that's really, they're complicated and deep and problematic. We have a prayer of fixing them. If you had a prayer of fixing the ones that you did in the way that you did, and we see it because you're human and you're with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm taking a ride on the Greyhound bus line. I'm riding the front seat to Jackson this time. Hallelujah, I'm a traveler. Hallelujah, you're fine. Hallelujah,
I'm a. You're listening to Caribbean Forum here with Ron Bob Semple on the Yahoo Radio Network. You're listening to Congressman John Lewis and some of the Freedom Riders, an excerpt from the documentary, which tells the story of an overlooked piece of not only civil rights history, but American history. It was written by Stanley Nelson, who now joins us. Mr. Nelson, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. First of all, Mr. Nelson, I had the opportunity of viewing this film a few weeks ago, and congratulations are in order to you and your team in producing such a fine and important film.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a real honor to be able to make this film.
It's. I'm sure it was. Stanley, you're not just a filmmaker, are you? You seem to give voice to important issues that are overlooked by popular culture.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of great stories, especially in the African-American community, that are not being told, and are especially not being told by us. And I think that, you know, we have a special insight, a special love, a special connection to these stories that makes them special when we tell them and tell them right.
Why do you think that is, Mr. Nelson, that it's not being told by us?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of times we don't have access to the power and the money to be able to produce these kind of films. And that's one of the things that we need to do. I think that there was a time when, you know, maybe in the 70s, 80s, when there was a demand that we kind of tell our own stories, and that was looked to, and funders and stations, kind of had to look at that. But now that's kind of gone. You know, that kind of movement is gone. So it doesn't really matter to stations and others, funders, who tells our story or who tells these stories. I think it's important for us to, you know, to demand that we, in very general terms, tell our own story.
Is there a certain style that you have adopted in making your documentaries?
I hope not. I mean, I try to make, you know, each style fit the story. I think that's what I'm trying to do. I think each story, you know, has a way of being told. I've been privileged to be able to tell some really great stories. So, you know, the murder of Emmett Till and
right.
Jonestown and other stories. And so I think that, you know, Freedom Riders, I think that in some ways, you know, I'm not trying to do anything exceptionally fancy to make my mark as a director what I'm trying to do is just tell this story as well as I can, because I think the story is brilliant and beautiful enough. And if I can tell the story, and if I can put the emotion and the feeling into the story, and also, you know, all that I've learned in over 30 years of filmmaking into the story, that it'll move audience and sway audiences, and that's what I'm trying to do.
I'm going to ask you a two-handed question. Tell us about your experience with the murder of Emmett Till documentary that you did. And you just used a key word a moment ago. How often do you get emotionally caught up in some of your films? And does that affect your creativity?
I think that my experience with the murder of Emmett Till, this was a kind of a story that I felt like I had known all my life. you know, the iconic pictures that Jet publishes every year of Emmett Till's mutilated body is something that I've been seeing all my life. And so, again, this was a real privilege to be able to try to tell this story. I think that, you know, I'm not sure if I exactly get caught up emotionally in the stories. I don't think I do. I think that I'm trying to convey the emotion of the story, the emotion that I feel, the emotion that the story warrants and that the characters in the story feel. I'm trying to portray those in the film. You know, it's 50 years ago, so it's not that I'm angered by it in that way. I'm trying to tell the story, but to tell it in a way that seems very objective. But at the same time, the stories are so powerful that they warrant objectivity.
So you imagine, as a human being, you may at times have to suppress that anger.
Well, I think that by having the story appear to be objective, and you know, and I don't have to throw myself in my opinion as director. You know, I mean, there's no doubt, you know, who the heroes are and who the villains are in a film like Emmett Till or in a film like Freedom Riders. So, you know, that I'm just, again, trying to convey the emotion of the story. I do want to say over and over again that Freedom Riders will be on May 16th.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, on PBS, Monday,
right, we'll
May
make 16th, sure that is done, yes.
On American Experience. And one thing that you know, I've been doing, we just had a screening last night in Washington, D.C., and one thing that I've been doing over and over again at the screenings is telling people that the date, of course, and the time it's going to be on, but also that they should let people know. I mean, what Freedom Riders is about, the film is about the power that we have as individuals. And I think so many times, as African Americans, you know, we talk about the power that we don't have. And I think one of the things we need to talk about is the power that we do have. And one of that, you know, that power is we are a community. We are a family, you know. So the more people who hear this program, let other people know. You know, you've got to watch this program. You got to tune in on May 16th to Freedom Riders. And then call your local station and tell them how much you liked it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, because the thing about PBS is that, you know, if they get 10 calls in any given city, then that to them is a resounding voice. You know that, you know, all we got to do is get 10 people to call, you know, their local PBS station after the film and say, "Hey, that was great."
Yeah.
You know, I just want to tell you that was great, and put on more shows like that, and we'll see more shows like that. You know, if we don't watch and if we don't call, then you know, where what complaint do we have when they don't show programs that are about us?
You have made several other documentaries, as you mentioned, such as Native Americans, We Shall Remain, the Jonestown, the Life and Death of the People's Temple, and Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind, which I had the privilege of working with you on. Stanley, take us through the process of putting together such films.
Well, I think the first thing, obviously, is trying to raise money for the films, and that's a complicated process, but so we're going to talk about that. But after you've gotten money to raise the films, then I think, you know, what I've done is, you know, once we get the team assembled to make the film, one of the things that we do from the first day is start thinking about what kind of, if it's a historical film like Marcus Garvey or Freedom Riders, you know, what are the video or the footage that we can use? What are the pictures that we can use? What's the music? What's the music of the time? Is there audio, radio, anything else that we can use, you know, to enhance this story? And let's start looking at it now. So typically a film like these films might take between a year and 2 years to make.
Mm.
We're looking at, you know, we're looking for footage, we're looking for pictures, we're looking for music for that whole two-year period. It's not like we get the film together, you know, and then start looking for pictures. We start looking for the audio and visual material from the very, very first day. And the next thing to do is, you know, we go about trying to find witnesses, to trying to find who is going to talk in the film, who's going to speak in the film, and that's a process of just trying to talk to as many people as we can, you know, just not interviewing them for the film, but just talking to them on the phone, going to see them, and making the net as wide as we can. And then once we've kind of done that, we then start to narrow it down and say, okay, who are we going to actually interview for the film? Because you usually can't afford to interview everybody.
Right.
That has to be a limited amount of people.
How do you choose your film topics, Mr. Nelson?
Well, I think that I try to, you know, when I'm doing historical documentaries or anything I'm doing, I try to do something that I feel is really important to me, but also to my community, which is, you know, the first community is African-American people, and then the second is, you know, Americans in general, because I feel like our history is also is a history of everybody, and our stories are important and entertaining, you know, for everybody. So that's what I'm doing, and then I'm trying to look at stories that in some ways have some kind of resonance today. So, you know, Marcus Garvey's story is a story that has resonance today. It's not, you know, it's not a story that lives in some kind of historical bubble. It has nothing to do with today. It has everything to do with who we are today.
That's right.
Freedom Riders is a story of, you know, about stepping out there and taking a chance and making change, and how, you know, 12 people got on a bus in Washington, D.C. And started a movement that became, you know, one of the first real steps in the civil rights movement, which changed our world. So I'm looking for big, you know, important stories that again have resonance today. Because when you start a film, you know, you don't know. You don't know that, you know, it might take, you know, 7, 5, 10 years to raise the money to make the film. So when I say a film takes, you know, a year or two to make, that's after you have the money, which that could take who knows how long. So, you know, you want to, when I go into it, I want to try to be making something that I feel is important that might take me, you know, 5 to 10 years. Part of that is the lesson of my own career. The first film that I made, the first major documentary, was $2 and a Dream, the story of Madam C.J. Walker. And that took me 7 years to make. And, you know, it was a very successful film in a lot of ways. It was on PBS. It won some awards. And, you know, I thought things would be easier. But the second film, major film I made, The Black Press, Soldiers Without Swords, also took another 7 years to make. And so, you know, I learned that you know, going in, you don't know how long these projects might take. And so it better be something that is really important.
Are these films
really
readily available, Stanley?
Yeah, the way to find out about all the films is to go to our website. My company is Firelight Media. And if you go to firelightmedia.org, you can find out information on all the films, on what we're working on some of the other things we're doing. So once again, it's firelightmedia.org. I think you can add yourself to our email list, and you know, that way you'll get updates on things that are happening with us.
Right. You just mentioned Marcus Garvey, and as I mentioned, yeah, we worked together on that project. There was some controversy, especially during post-discussions with the public. Is that part for the cause?
Yeah, I think Garvey was a little bit more vehement than other films, because I think that
to say,
you know,
the
Garvey
least,
Garvey is such a controversial figure, you know, and I think that my duty as a filmmaker in telling history is to tell it as accurately as I can. So I think that although Marcus Garvey, you know, was an incredible hero with an incredible influence on African Americans in his day and still today, there were a lot of things that I think mistakes he made and things that he did that were not, you know, that could have been done better, I think. So, you know, I think there's a controversy, because I think a lot of people, you know, still want to see our heroes as perfect. But that's not, you know, that's not how they are. Our heroes are human. And I think it's important that we understand that our heroes are human. Or how do you create, you know, new heroes as we go forward? You know, how do you create people who do marvelous things as we go forward? If you know, a young child thinks, well, I could never be a Marcus Garvey or Martin Luther King, because these guys were saints, these guys were gods, these guys were unhuman. I can't do that. No, they were human. They were human with all the problems and you know that humans have. But they still did great things, and that's what's important, I think.
Is your objective to have your films raise questions or answer them?
I think it's both. I mean, I think the films do both. I think the film's gonna always give new information. If you sit there for an hour and a half, 2 hours with a film, you're gonna learn something you didn't know. And I think that's what we want to do. We want to do that entertainingly. But also, they're gonna always raise questions and raise thoughts. So that when we screen Freedom Riders, which we're out there doing now, the discussions afterwards are amazing because people have questions and thoughts on what we've done. So I think we're trying to really do both.
You deal with figures, Stanley, who are somewhat heroic. Who are some of your heroes and or sheroes?
I don't really know. I kind of don't think in those terms. I think that there's part of it is that I try not to have this kind of great man great woman theory of history. And what I'm trying to do is talk about history in terms of everyday and everyday people. So I kind of don't think in that way. I think that there's my heroes will probably be the same people that are heroes to everybody. But I also try to again see people as humans. That all of these people are human who did great things, which makes it even more astounding that humans rise above and do great things. And that's the story of the Freedom Riders. It's so amazing is that these people came out of obscurity, did this hugely great thing at great personal risk to themselves, and then most of them went back into obscurity. But they did this incredible thing and risked their lives so that we would have change in this country, which in some ways is what allows things like you and I to have this conversation on the radio. I would never. There was, when I was growing up, there was nothing such as an African American director. There were none. I mean, there was not one person directing any kind of film. So this, the sacrifices that the Freedom Riders made, in some ways, is what allows us to have this conversation today.
Speaking of when you were growing up, Stanley, this year is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. We are both celebrating an important milestone this year. If you know what I'm talking about. when you were a young man, Stanley, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, did your parents tell you about the Freedom Riders?
Not specifically. I mean, I grew up. I'm about to be 60,
that's the milestone I'm talking about.
Yeah, so I was around 10 at the time of the Freedom Riders, and in my teens during the Civil Rights Movement, and the later Civil Rights. So I have a much better, clearer memory of the kind of later Civil Rights Movement. Coming home from school and watching it on the news, and we did talk about those things. But the Freedom Riders were really early in the Civil Rights Movement, and that's one of the things that makes the story so great, is that it's about the Civil Rights Movement becoming the Civil Rights Movement. It's about it kind of coalescing. It's about one of the first national actions in the Civil Rights Movement. And I think also it's just this kind of great story with these kind of ups and downs, and you don't know who's going to win and what's going to happen, and because I challenge anybody that they, if they think they know the story of the Freedom Riders, see the film, because you do not.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple. Our special guest this morning is Stanley Nelson. He is the writer and director of Freedom Riders, which will be premiering on PBS television on May 16th. Mr. Nelson has made several documentaries, Wounded Knee, as I mentioned, the We Shall Return, the landmark series on Native Americans, Jonestown, the life and death of peoples of the People's Temple, Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind, and in his 2005 film, Sweet Honey in the Rock, Raise Your Voice. Stanley, because of this, the racial divide in the South, during the height of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Was there apprehension in folks regurgitating and talking about their involvement in the struggle when you were putting this film together?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that one of the things that happened for us is that so many of the Freedom Riders had not really had a lot of chance to talk about it. Because, as I said, so many of them had kind of gone back into obscurity, you know, and nobody was asking them on a day-to-day basis, you know, tell me about your experiences, you know, on the Freedom Rides. So for in some ways, you know, the interviews in the film, you know, are wonderful. I mean, they look great, but, you know, I can't pat myself on the back too much for being a great interviewer because, in some ways, I asked a couple of questions, and this dam broke. And my job was to try to get the Freedom Riders to shut up, you know, to try to be quiet because they wanted to tell me the whole story. Because a lot of them, you know, went on to other lives and hadn't been asked about this thing that really, you know, took place within a couple of months of 1961. You know, it was two or three months in 1961. That the Freedom Ride is condensed and capitalized in this one little time period.
Were there any surprises you encountered?
Well, I think the whole story is a surprise for me. You know, the ups and downs, the ins and outs. It's like a roller coaster ride. You know, but I think one of the things is that, you know, there's this kind of national and international element to the story. So on one level, you have the Freedom Riders being, you know, on these two buses going through the South, you know, the Greyhound bus and the Trailways bus just going through the South. You know, and on the other hand, you have the Kennedys on a national level involved. You have, you know, Russia and Cuba, Czechoslovakia all commenting and all, you know, talking about the Freedom Rides and saying, well, you know, the Kennedys are talking about how great the U.S. is, but, you know, in the U.S., certain of their citizens can't even get on a bus and ride from one place to the other. You know, you call that freedom, you call that democracy. So the Freedom Riders are used as this kind of Cold War tool. You know, so there's this kind of international thing, but on another level, there's some people riding in a bus through the South.
Oh, wow. After seeing this film, Stanley, what do you want viewers to take away from Freedom Riders?
Well, I think on a very simple level, you know, I think we should know this story. It's an incredible story. But I think on the other hand, it's a story of, you know, a bunch of people, mostly young people, who just set out at great personal risk with no guarantee of success. You know, all the powers that be are lined up against them, and they set out on their own to make a change because they see that something is wrong, and they do that. I think it's really important that we understand that we have to be involved if we want change to be made. That going to vote, you know, once every 2 or 4 years, it takes 10 minutes, is not fulfilling your civic duty. You know, it's not. And that, you know, if young people, we really wanted this to be a film that young people could see and get into. So the film has kind of a very, you know, kind of fast pace. It's almost an adventure story. That young people have to become involved. You know, if you're 20 years old, 30 years old, then you got 40 or 50 or 60 years more that you're going to have to live with what's going on in this country. And if you're not involved in it, then, you know, what excuse do you have with what comes down the pike? You know, it's like, hey, you know, you've got to be involved. I think the Freedom Rider shows, you know, a clear lesson of what happens. You know, it's a story of 12 people, you know, 6 blacks, 6 whites, who just decide that they're going to get on Greyhound and Trailways buses in Washington, D.C., and take those buses to New Orleans and sit together. White people and the black people are going to sit together on the buses, they're going to eat together in the restaurants, whites are going to use the colored-only restrooms, the black people are going to use the whites-only restrooms. This is at the height of segregation in 1961, and they're just going to see what happens. And these 12 people end up being over 400 people. It becomes this huge movement, and the signs in bus stations that say white and colored are taken down because of what the Freedom Riders do, and they do it in 3 months. That's a story that we should know.
What's next for Stanley Nelson and Firelight Media Productions?
We've got a bunch of things going on. We're actually in editing for a film on Jesse Owens and the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, this kind of clash between Hitler and Jesse Owens, African-American. But we just got raised some money to do three different series. One, the first one is on the Black Panther Party, and kind of looking at a film on the Black Panther Party. There have been a lot of films that kind of include a little bit of the party, but this is a film on the rise and fall of the Black Panther Party. A film on historic black colleges and universities, looking at American history through the eyes of black universities. And another four-hour series on the Atlantic slave trade.
Wow.
And looking at the slave trade as a huge international business that included Europe, Africa, and the New World.
Well, your plate is pretty filled, isn't it?
Yeah, it's filled. We still got some money to raise on those last three, so we're kind of in the fundraising mode. But
Before I let you go, Stanley, a couple of weeks ago I spoke with you, and you were in Beijing. Beijing. Were you there promoting Freedom Riders?
Yeah, I was there with a program with the Sundance Film Festival, and
they took
a couple of films over there to China. We went to three cities in China and showed Freedom Riders, and got great, great, great response. It was just incredible to see, just to see your film with Chinese subtitles. My film with Chinese subtitles was incredible. But to show the film, we showed the film to mainly students, and have their questions and have them talk about the Freedom Rides and the Civil Rights Movement and how that applies to movements in China. And the one great question we got was, one student asked me, why was there segregation in the U.S., which was such a beautiful question. It was so beautiful. It was so kind of, elemental. It was so innocent, it was not an easy question to answer.
I'm sure.
But, that's the kind of questions we got and the kind of discussions we had. It was a really, really wonderful and amazing experience for me.
It just goes to show that young people all over the world are hungry for knowledge and to be educated about other cultures.
Yeah, and it shows, too, what I said earlier, that our stories are universal.
Absolutely.
Our stories are universal. The struggles and the things that we go through here in the United States as black people are universal. And see my film up there in China, and discussions about it in China just goes to prove that.
Well, Stanley Nelson, thank you very much, my brother. My hat and my shoes and everything are off to you for your stick-to-itiveness. I know you have a passion for telling our story, and it's I know it's not easy, and you very well know that, especially when one has to raise a lot of money to make these films. But congratulations to you and your team. And just to remind you, listeners, the American Experience of Freedom Riders will be aired on Monday, May 16th at 9 p.m. You should check your local listings on the PBS network. And please spread the word, because this is an extremely important film. Do you feel that this film, Stanley, should be shown in just about every school?
Yeah, I think it should. We've had that comment over and over again at screenings that we've done at festivals and other screenings. We've actually had people who had school systems come down to us and say, look, we're going to work to get this film shown in every school. I think Chicago is going to show it in every high school, other things like that. So, yes, and we've screened the film before. I have 12-year-old twins, and we've screened the film for people as young as my kids in their class, and they've just been great. They understand it. They have great questions. It's a great inspiration. High school, colleges that we've shown it at have just been amazing.
Sometimes.
I should also say, if I can real quick, is one thing that's happening this week is that we have a group who are leaving Washington, D.C., a group of 40 college students who are recreating the Freedom Rides and going from Washington, D.C. down to New Orleans, and they're, you know, blogging and tweeting and writing and doing everything to get the message out. And they're going down, and there's, I think, five or six of the original Freedom Riders on the buses with them, and they're doing reports, you know, on all different media about it. So, you know, I am sure you can Google it or something and find out more about it and how to get in touch with them. But, you know, that's, we're actually doing the orientation today and tomorrow in Washington, D.C., and then they're off to recreate the Freedom Ride, so it's great.
Well, this social media is really doing wonders, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and you know, there's no excuse.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. That's one of the big things about social media. You know, there's no excuse for us not to get the word out. You know, we can get the word out nowadays where, I mean, we used to do it, you know, I was, when I was a kid, you know, there were no black shows on TV, no black people, but if, you know, James Brown or Duke Ellington or somebody appeared on Ed Sullivan's show, which was a variety show, you know, all of a sudden your phone would start to ring, you know, and they'd say, oh, and it would be your aunt or your neighbor or your friend saying, you know, James Brown's going to be on, turn it on, you know, and we would, that's how we would communicate. Today we've got so many different ways of communicating. There's so many ways for us to tell, you know, our family, our friends, our loved ones, you know, that Freedom Riders is coming on May 16th on PBS.
Absolutely, at 9 p.m. Check your
local listings. There's no excuse for us not to do that. We've got to use the power that we have.
Absolutely. Stanley Nelson, thank you very much for joining us here on Caribbean Forum. Again, Freedom Riders, written and directed by Stanley Nelson. The American Experience, Freedom Riders, will be shown on PBS, the premiere of May 16th at 9 p.m. Stanley, thank you very much, and we'll be in touch, my brother.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yes, that was Stanley Nelson. And speaking of freedom, let's go to Mr. Byron Lee. As he talked about Freedom Street. Are we going to return after this musical break into our Caribbean Theater of the Mind segment? The Caribbean Theater from the Caribbean. Or the Caribbean Cultural Theater. Be back in a shake.
Walk it. Sundays from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll bring you Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Semple. A relaxing 3 hours of music from around the world. Music is the food of love. So tune in every Sunday evening from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Golden Sunday Sounds.
For news, views, interviews, and thought-provoking discussions, tune in to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 Eastern Standard Time on the Uhuru Radio Network.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Semple here on the Uhuru Radio Network.
Yes, welcome back to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. Just had that rather interesting
conversation with Stanley Nelson, the director of Freedom Riders. And in our Caribbean Theater of the Mind segment, we have joining us this morning the executive director of the Caribbean Cultural Theater, Mr. Ewan MacDonald, and one of the poets. And Nandi, please forgive me, I may do injustice to your name, but Nandi K.U. Ugunlade. Are we on the line? Are you there, Ewan? Ewan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Ron.
Okay, how are you doing? I'm just trying to reconnect with
Nandi.
With Nandi.
Okay.
And let me see if I can get her back on.
I'm here.
Nandi, you're there. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm fine, thanks.
Okay. Ewan, are you still with us? Okay. I'm just trying to reconnect Ewan with us, but while I've got you on the line, Nandi, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here this morning.
Absolutely. And I know the upcoming event, Poets and Passions, there. Just tell us a little bit about Nandi and how you got involved in poetry.
Well, actually, I am not a poet, actually. I dabble a little bit, but I would never consider myself a poet. Actually, my form is the novel, and at Poets and Passion this Friday, I will be a guest, and I will be...
Yes, go ahead. Are you still there?
Yes, hello?
Yes, you're still there, Nandi? Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I'm here. Yes. So, in terms of my work as a writer, I've been involved in theater. Actually, is my original form for a very long time. You know, my work appeared in the Toronto Fringe and various stages in Trinidad and Tobago, and also here in New York. I also have written for academic journals, but this is my first foray into the magic of the novel.
How does that feel?
It's therapeutic, I should say. It's actually cathartic. I actually achieved a great catharsis from it because, they always say that a writer's first novel actually has various degrees of biography. It's actually autobiographical. So in many ways, I was able to, look at this whole idea of being a woman and being an immigrant from the Caribbean in America. So it is one of the highlights of my life that I was able to, at least look at various women and their experiences, particularly in the kind of underbelly in New York City life, that of being, say, like maybe a undocumented immigrant, being a nanny, and being here and just trying to make it, and all the complexity of that.
Are you saying that it is a disadvantage being a woman and from the Caribbean?
I'm not actually. Well, where it concerns this particular class of women, which are the nannies and the elder care workers, because for one thing, it's only very recently that there was any semblance of some sort of rights for domestic workers, And then, you know, for me, what my lover particularly looks at is the whole idea of many of us, you know, you were teachers, social workers, you know, professional women in the Caribbean, and then you give that up, and then you come because, you know, America, of course, you know, the streets are paved in gold, and it's a lot of opportunity, and many of the times, you know, you say, well, let me do this so that I can, my children can have a better life. But then you come, and like the my protagonist, Fandi, she had this whole idea that, okay, so I'm gonna be able to do better for the people I left behind. But then what happens? You know, 20 years later, you're still on the playground waiting for something to happen.
What do you
have?
Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So for me, it was very exciting to be able to just look at this particular, to give voice to these women, this particular group of women who come from the Caribbean and are doing this type of work in America.
What makes it so different between the woman from the Caribbean region and a woman from, say, North America culturally?
Culturally, they're very, you know, there are various differences. I remember when I first came to America, and actually my degree is in journalism, but when I came here, I wanted to get out of journalism, and I wanted to do more, you know, fiction. So I actually went back and I started to take another degree, this time in literature. And one of the first things my sociology professor said to me, she actually talked about this whole idea of women and nannies, and just told me very clearly that American women would not do this type of work, and why are Caribbean women coming to do this here in America? So I think that right there is the foundation of the difference between, you know, the cultural differences between the two types of women, because Caribbean women, I think, are more prepared to do, you know, they would do anything, whatever type of job it is, that could probably give them a leg up so that they can make things better for their generations. Whereas African American women, understandably, because of the whole legacy of the way enslavement was, the horrific nature of it here in America, they of course would look at it another way and say, you know, after everything my people went through, I'm not going to be doing that type of work. So, you know, there are various kinds of differences, but where it pertains to my novel, The True Nanny Diaries, I think that is, you know, the basic kind of difference between the two groups.
How did that difference affect you moving forward in your career?
How did it affect me? Well, originally, I mean, when I started, I actually started at Amnagi Evers College when we came here, and I had a very firm idea of what I wanted to do, and I just went ahead and did it and got all the awards and that kind of thing. But then very soon, because of matters not, you know, under my control, I found myself for a little while babysitting in Manhattan, and that to me, that was, I mean, it was absolutely devastating, because again, here was I, you know, and I've done, you know, so many things, interesting things. But, you know, here was I, you know, babysitting. And
but you also used that as a stepping stone, didn't you?
Yeah. I didn't intend to do it, but at first it was kind of, as I said, you know, it was therapy, because I was writing about this. And then all of a sudden, you know, it started to become really serious, and it just took on a life that was bigger than me. You know, so for sure, you know, being here in America and having all these interesting experiences, you know, certainly affected me, the way, the direction my life has gone culturally and as a writer.
Tell us about your novel, The True Nanny Diaries.
Okay, well, the novel revolves around Vandi West, and she left a native Trinidad and Tobago to study at the prestigious Columbia University here in America. But through no fault of her own, she ends up living under the radar as an illegal immigrant, basically babysitting to survive. You know, so Vandi decided, you know, I'll just babysit for a little while, and then, you know, when I get enough money, I'm going to go back to Colombia. But 20 years later, she's still on the playground, just nursing her deranged dreams. Basically, she starts focusing her intuition and her cutting wit on a little babysitting circle, which involved a senior citizen, Madame Lucian. And Madame Lucian is a very interesting woman. You know, she came here from St. Lucia at 65 and starts baking bread from a Flatbush apartment and also supplementing that with babysitting. And then, you know, also in the circle is Monica, who she basically has an agenda, and she is going to, as far as she's concerned, I'm getting my green card, my marriage, and whatever little perks I have to stir in there, then so be it. You know? And then Ava, this is Vali's one-time confidant, and she's just on the verge of this impending success, getting her degree and, you know, achieving the American dream. And this has Vali really unnerved because she, in her mind, she should have been the one, given her ambitions and her, you know, her brilliance. So Vali, set further and further adrift from her dream of becoming an award-winning writer. She becomes hopefully entangled in the, you know, just the demands of the latest employers. And then she has a chance encounter with her wildly successful twin sister, and this just pushes her to the brink. And at that point, it's either sink or swim.
Well, Nandi, I wish you all the best in the event on the 13th. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back with the artistic director, Mr. E. Wayne McDonald.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're like the rose of Sharon to me in Jaja's garden. Talking to my black African princess, cool African dancer. You're the most attractive person I ever behold.
Hi, Ewing, sorry about that, man.
No problem.
Okay, just stand by for me. I'll be with you in about a minute.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Oh, yes, your black complexion is a beauty to the nation. Sweet African princess, cool African damsel, you're the most beautiful woman that God ever made. You're like the rose of Sharon to me in Jaja's garden. Banana African princess, so lovely African damsel.
The one and only Mr. Freddie McGregor, Sweet African Princess. You listen to Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob
Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. And we just chatted with one of the performers at the upcoming Poets and Passions that's being produced by the Caribbean Cultural Theater. It's a theater immersion experience presenting the work of Caribbean-based and or influential writers, performers, and practitioners. And the artistic director of the E. Wayne McDonald joined us this morning. E. Wayne, good morning, and again, welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Absolutely. E. Wayne, just give us a brief history of the Caribbean Cultural Theater and its importance.
We're a Brooklyn-based performing arts company. We've been doing work in the folk tradition, film, theater, and literature for the past 10 years. This particular series that we're focused on, Poets and Passion, is a mix of featured writers, some of whom are tremendously acclaimed, Kamal Brathwaite, E.R. Braithwaite, Linton Kwesi Johnson, along with emerging writers, and we also have an open mic component. But what we try to do above and beyond just showcasing these artists' work is also to try and place the art in a larger societal context. So, for instance, when we did Elizabeth Nunes' book earlier this year, part of the work dealt with cancer, and we created the linkages between literature and healthcare for a larger discussion. This session coming up on Friday, Friday the 13th of May at St. Francis College, downtown Brooklyn, features three women writers from the region writing in long form, short stories or novels. Marie Surratt from Haiti, doing excerpt from her piece in the anthology Haiti Noir, edited by Edwidge Danticat. Rosalind McClymouth from Guyana, doing an excerpt from Middle Ground. And the person you just spoke to, Nandi Kai, doing an excerpt from her book, The Middle Passage. The Nanny Diaries, sorry. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what we've been doing. So this particular series, the Poets and Passion series, we are in our fifth year. We are
tremendously fascinated by the response. And the writers have been phenomenal, both in terms of their craft, but also in terms as spokesperson to the aspirations of our communities, the conflicts within our communities. And we're looking forward to this coming Friday session on the 13th.
You mentioned a little while ago, Ewan, about the topic of cancer that you dealt with. I don't know if it was specifically throughout the Caribbean region. But last weekend, I think it was, I had the editor of a new magazine. It's called Next Generation. And there are a couple of articles in there talking about the health situation in the Caribbean. There is, or there should be, concern as to what's happening in the Caribbean health-wise.
Well, I think there's always concern. I don't know if there's always is there an equal amount of action behind the concern. Our infrastructure is not up to par. Many of our societies are still somewhat steeped in tradition, and therefore. Or steeped in tradition, or steeped in ignorance. And therefore, a lot of what is considered routine in either urban settings or in metropolitan societies, many of that we do not do as part of our regular health maintenance.
Right, right.
It's interesting that a previous generation was always concerned about giving you a washout
or a wash
at down. The beginning of the school year. Yeah, you drink your portion, you drink your tea, and you get a half a orange to soothe the bad taste. But a lot of that maintenance of health we seem to have left along the way in our drive towards modernization. And also we're somewhat secretive society, conservative probably a better term for it. And
it's
therefore
also embarrassment too.
Yes, and therefore discussing a lot of these things. And finding the support that there is for health maintenance is not there. And one of the things we found tremendously empowering during that particular session was that there were quite a number of women in the audience who were willing to get up and declare that they were recovering from cancer themselves, that they have either had a mastectomy or were contemplating it, and the sort of hurdles, both physical and psychological, that they had to go through. And I don't think we create enough fora for our people to discuss these issues. And they are culturally sensitive. You know, as you did mention with regard to embarrassment, but part of the hurdle to overcome that is information. And we don't always have that at our disposal.
Lack of education also. When I say lack of education, I mean lack of being educated about a certain disease.
True. And how to overcome it. For instance, my recollection of patients of cancer and their caregivers run the gauntlet growing up. I remember one particular occasion, there was a custodian at a particular school, and in speaking to her, we realized that she may indeed lose one of her jobs, which was serving in the cafeteria, because the school administration had found out that her husband, not she, but her husband was at that time dying from cancer.
Mm.
And the administration was up in arms that she had not informed them that her husband was sick from cancer. And therefore, after much discussion, she was barred from the kitchen. This was circa 1980-something.
Wow.
Nobody on that board had less than a master's degree. What is the connection between she providing care for her husband and she working in a kitchen?
Wow.
So it's things like that. I also know of a case in my family. My grandmother had a mastectomy as far back as the 50s. I wasn't even aware that they were doing that as far back as then. So it runs the gauntlet. What is the information out there? how do we as a society process this? And again, we're talking with regard to cancer, which is not communicable. Once you get to communicable diseases, then all bets are off.
Yeah, it is a horse of a different color.
The situation with regard to our citizens dealing with HIV/AIDS is phenomenal, both in terms of the hope in some pockets of our society and the neglect in many more. And we needed to create the environment that information can freely flow, but we also need to find culturally sensitive vehicles for making this possible. One of the ongoing disease areas that we don't address are sexually transmitted diseases.
Well, that's a whole nother topic, Ewan, and we don't have much time left. And I want to make sure that you tell our listeners about the event coming up next Friday, May 13th.
Yes, Friday, May 13th, we're downtown Brooklyn again, our monthly session of Poets and Passion. And this go-round is a woman team, and we're featuring three women writers, one from Haiti, one from Trinidad and Tobago, one from Guyana.
For further information, how can one get that?
718-783-8345 or
718-783-8345.
Sorry, 718-783-8345. That's 718-783-8345. And we're presently on Facebook at Caribbean Cultural Theatre.
Great. That's Women Things at St. Francis College in Remsen Street in downtown Brooklyn. Ewan McDonald, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. And I have to say 7:30 and we start on time.
All right.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks
very much. Yes, I'll be coming to the end of the of our broadcast this morning. I'd like to thank Mr. Stanley Nelson, the director of Freedom Riders, and also like to thank Nandi K.U. Ogunlade, the authors and the poets that will be presenting at the Poets and Passions in Brooklyn on the 13th. I'd also like to thank Ms. Tangerine Clark of the Guyana Cultural Association for their event tomorrow, guyfolkfest.org. Watch your thoughts, they become words. Watch your words, they become actions. Watch your actions, they become habits. Watch your habits, they become character. Watch your character, for it becomes your destiny. Those 10 two-letter words, if it is to be, it is up to me. See you tomorrow at 7 p.m. for Golden Sunday Sounds. I'm Ron Bob Semple. Have a pleasant evening.